Listening on the internet, you may use the toll-free line that's 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you certainly, questions, comments, you certainly are welcome to call. Professor Jackson, hello.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks, and yourself?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Well, we're glad that you could spend a little time talking with us. I was really interested in the description of the talk that you gave. This was the 2005 Bazzani Lecture in Public Affairs back at the end of November. And I think that it is true. And if you take a look at what's written in the media about America at this point, you do often get a sense that it is a very polarized country and that we have two major kind of camps that are diametrically opposed, that are at war with one another. You get the sense sometimes that America is a country that is at war with itself and that on some very basic and very emotional issues, homosexuality and abortion are probably two of the big ones, but also things that have with parenting, things that have to do with public education and what we teach and how we teach it, economic philosophies, just a whole host of issues. You get this impression that, in fact, America is very, very divided and there isn't much in the way of middle ground. Now, having said all that, is that, in fact, the case? Is that what America is like at this point?
Well, the perception is certainly there that that's the situation. And there was a recent book by Wayne Baker that I discussed on America's crisis of values, in which he took a close look at this particular issue and actually argued that that's not the case at all. That is, the perception is true that people think that we're at some kind of crisis, but when you actually look at the data, it doesn't really fully support that.
Hmm. Well, is there a representative kind of issue or a couple of issues that the conventional wisdom says there's this great divide and this great gulf where, in fact, if you look at survey data, if you actually go out and ask people, you find that in fact, most of the people seem to be falling sort of in the middle of the continuum or if not that, that, in fact, people generally seem to agree.
Well, things haven't changed much. I was, one of the things I talked about was the work by the Gallup poll, for example, since 1975. And their question about abortions. So in 1975, about 54% of Americans believed that abortion should be legal only under certain circumstances. And in 2005, 54% of Americans believed that. And the number has not jumped around very much in the intervening years. So about 23% believed that it should be legal under any circumstances. And in 1975, 22% of the American population believe that. So it's hard to find the fact that there's been this change and polarization in terms of that particular value, at least. But it's also true for other areas as well. So you see the same thing in terms of homosexual relations between consenting adults. 49% of the people today say that it should be legal, and in 1977, about 45% of the people thought it should be legal. So there's been some changes in that over time, but for the most part, fairly constant.
Well, what does it tell us then that we have this perception that there is this kind of great divide, that we do have this kind of cultural war going on?
Well, part of the issue has to do with regard to the ways in which our kind of political positioning has been shown over the last few years, the kind of blue state, red state, which everybody is familiar with, which shows this issue of polarization. But of course, as some people have pointed out, when you take a look at that a little bit more fine grain, besides electoral votes, which are represented by the states, of course, and you look at counties or other divisions, that we actually live in a very purple place, where you find people of both political camps, coexisting very well across all the states in the union. So, in some ways, it's the ways in which things have been represented and the ways in which this polarization has been presented, which just doesn't jive with the facts.
Hmm. Well, does that have? I expect that has something to do with media and how it is that we talk about these issues. But I suppose it also has something to do with how those groups, organizations, who are most committed to some particular position, how it is they talk about what they believe, what they think other people believe, and perhaps what should, you know, what their perception of what the world is and what the world should be. And so it's a combination of some of the strongest voices and the way that the media covers them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's exactly what's happened. If we take a look at the kind of rise in talk radio and kind of talk television, and we look at who those voices are, they're often very strident and also oftentimes very unidimensional. We've also had a rise in kind of single issue groups, who are very loud with regard to their positions, irregardless of what those positions are, and it gives the impression. This is the reason why I say it's a perception that indeed there's this tremendous polarization. But you know, most Americans are relatively sensible. They fall somewhere within the kind of political and social middle, and you know their particular perceptions and so on change as a function of what's important to them. So I think you're absolutely correct about that. I think this is what's producing this kind of perception of a crisis, which I don't really think is there.
Mm. You know, after the last election, exit polls, reporters do what they always do, and then they go out there and they try to buttonhole people who are coming out after having voted and
yes.
ask them some questions. And I'm sure that also social scientists do the same thing. They're trying to find out if people would tell them how they voted, but also if people would tell them what was most important to them, what mm-hmm. what influenced them. And the big story was, at least at that time, was values and values voters. And that not in a general sense, but when you talk about that, values and values voters, it's actually a rather specific set of values and attitudes on those. And that it made it sound as if that somehow that was something new, that these people were an important force. Is that really true? And if you ask people, do you have strong values and are values important to you? And when you think about public policy and leadership, you consider those things. Is that somehow more true now than it has been in the past?
So that's exactly the way in which I would put it. Somehow people are presenting this as kind of as a new thing, that somehow, you know, in the historical past, whenever that might be, people weren't as concerned about these kinds of values and so on. But I think that's not true. I mean, you know, Americans have always been concerned about, how we raise our children, how do we educate them, are people getting the kind of religious training that they ought to get? And, you know, the one thing that's very interesting is that, you know, the United States is very high on these kinds of traditional values, has been for a long time, and continues today. It just seems to be much more of an emphasis on it. I mean, some people have claimed that, you know, it's oftentimes used as a kind of a political football, you know, among some of our major political parties, to make a big thing about, you know, who speaks for American values best, in a way for, you know, particular political ends. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But certainly we've seen more of that over the last 10 years than ever before, actually over the last 20 years or so.
Well, let me ask you one further question, and we have a caller here we'll get to. If we talked a little bit about what you could say about Americans' attitudes on a couple of particular, very controversial, hot-button issues. If you look at what Americans think about particular issues, and then you extract from them some kind of larger or more overarching set of attitudes that deal with things like relationship between individuals, relationships between people in their community, relationships between people and their government. I mean, if you ask something about, well, what are the larger values that Americans have? What sort of phrases really describe them? Is there a kind of an answer that you can give to a question?
Well, let me ask. We just finished a study, which was a comparative study on the five largest race and ethnic groups in the United States. So non-Hispanic whites, Latinos, Afro-Caribbeans, Afro-Americans, and Asian Americans. And we asked the question about religious beliefs, religious values, and we also collected information about voting and other kinds of things. And what we find is absolutely no relationship whatsoever among any of the groups. between their kind of religious beliefs and their vote choice. In fact, there was no relationship to voting at all. What we did find, though, was a kind of interesting relationship between kind of political cynicism, that is the kind of an issue having to do with significant differences among the parties and what they stand for and whether people voted, and that relationship was negative for all the groups. So the more people believed that it was kind of tweedly-dee and tweedly-dum in terms of choices, the less likely they were to vote, which I think is a much more potentially harmful situation for the ways in which democracy needs to operate.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with James Jackson. He is a social psychologist. He's director of the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan, and he's also director of the Program for Research on Black Americans and has now for a long time been involved in doing research on, generally speaking, on the state of Black America. He's particularly interested in health issues and mental health issues. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here calling in on someone on a cell phone, so we'll go right there. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, just fine.
Excellent.
It's perfect, actually.
We were having some trouble earlier. Well, anyway, my question is right in line, actually, with what you were just talking about, and I was just hoping that you could elaborate a little bit more about the use of the apparent or perceived divisions and polarization in America by the major political parties to keep us divided. It seems to me, and some of the people that I talk to, that every time, for instance, there is a spike in resentment against the Bush administration in particular, that somehow all of a sudden there's an issue about gay marriage comes up, and all of a sudden there's a big protest, and that catches news media attention. It just seems as though, I hope I'm not being too cynical, but I'm wondering if you'll talk about the idea that maybe our current administration in particular is using this perceived polarization in Americans to its own political ends. Since I'm on a cell phone, I'm going to go ahead and hang up.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Professor Jackson, what do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I don't stand from getting accused of being a liberal academic. One has to be careful about that. But the fact is that it's hard to resist, I think, among political parties, particularly those in power, to try to retain that particular power. I think there has been this issue within the Republican Party to go from a minority party to become a majority party, how do you gain, this kind of loyalty from individuals and so on? And in some ways, the Republican Party has become a party of a lot of single-issue voters, people concerned about abortion, people concerned about, erosion of, certain kinds of religious freedoms, people concerned with regard to socialization of their children and how they're educated, people who are concerned about issues of creationism and so on. And that kind of coalition, I don't think, can hold together very long. But, historically, in some ways, the Democratic Party had a coalition for a very long time, which in some ways also depended upon pulling very disparate groups of people with different interests together and holding that as a coalition to be a majority party. So it's very difficult, I think, for any party in the United States when most of the people are kind of middle of the road and so on to gain an advantage in terms of numbers in order to win various different kinds of elections. So I think there's a tremendous temptation, I think, for people to push the kinds of buttons and to push them very hard that are going to bring people over to their particular side. Mm-hmm. But I think in the long run, it's not good for our democracy to have this kind of thing going on because it leads to these perceptions of these very, very big divisions.
Mm-hmm. We were talking a little bit earlier about the perceptions that people have about the cultural divide in America. I think that if you ask people, well, what other kind of divisions exist, they would say, well, there are some respects in which America is divided along racial lines and also along lines of social class, although that you're probably going to hear less about that because here in America we like to believe that there aren't any social classes, that doesn't exist. And everybody, you ask everybody what class they belong to, and an awful lot of people will say, well, middle. We like to think that everybody's middle class, and it's really not quite like that. I guess what I'm interested in is looking at divisions. If you look, as you say, you looked at people who fall into major ethnic demographics and their attitudes. I'm interested in what indeed might be a more important, where more important differences might lie, and whether indeed social economic class does tell you something about attitudes, or there is some link with attitudes, and I wonder, in fact, whether that it can be a more divisive kind of thing than race or ethnicity.
Well, I think it's all, you know, I mean, people forget, I think, in a way, that in the United States, if we think about race, and African Americans have been the racial group that oftentimes contrasted against non-Hispanic whites. But actually, in reality, that's a very small group of people in the United States. I mean, you're talking about 12 or 13% of the population, and certainly a smaller percentage of the adult population. And while that's been argued as a major dividing line, in some ways it's not. Data has shown over time that African Americans actually tend to be, much more socially conservative than our non-Hispanic whites on issues of religion, on issues of abortion, on issues of homosexuality, and so on. Yet people keep presenting this group as being very different, and that was actually one of the major issues that I tried to address the other day. There is much more variability, if you will, between individuals within race and ethnic groups than it is between the groups themselves. That is, there's much more commonality between groups than it is, there's more, you know, differences within groups than it is across groups. And a lot of people don't understand that very well. But the issue of social class, though, is becoming more of a problem in the United States. And in the sense that since in the 1970s, we've been really drifting apart. We're becoming much more an equal country in terms of in terms of social economic status, particularly in terms of who possesses the wealth in this country. Historically, the idea in the United States was that if we weren't all middle class, then, you know, we should certainly aspire to be all middle class. And that's been changing a lot over the last couple of decades.
Just going back to, you were talking a little bit earlier, again, because I raised it, a couple of the most controversial hot-button issues, one being abortion and the other being homosexuality. And you said that, in fact, if you take a look at people's attitudes on those issues today and then you go back to the 1970s, you find out that, in fact, that attitudes haven't really changed very much, that it's been very stable, attitudes have been very stable over that time when it comes to a woman's right to abortion with some restrictions and what it is consenting adults do behind closed doors. Having said that, though, there's an issue where the attitudes have been relatively stable. Has there been anything, if you take a look at attitudes on sort of standard set of issues over the last few decades, has there been anything where there has been some sort of a very dramatic change where social scientists would look at what people were saying in the 1970s and now what they say in 2005 and say, wait, we look at here. Look at what has happened here. Anything that really catches your eye that has changed?
Well, the one thing that's changed probably a lot, and then I don't have my hand on the pulse of all of this, but America's racial attitudes. The United States has become, in some ways, much less polarized around that in terms of attitudes than ever before. You know, the number of Americans who say interracial marriage is just fine, the number of people who believe in tolerance and so on has shown an incredible upsurge, where the vast majority of Americans today, you know, are actually very positive on those issues, irregardless of what their political orientation is or what their racial background may be. So in some ways, you know, we've shown incredible, you know, passivity over time in terms of this on that particular issue.
Well, that's interesting, given that it seems that, again, and this may go back to how it is that the media report on life in America today, you'd get the impression that there's a lot of tension around the issue of what has come to be called multiculturalism and how it is we manage and deal with and live with our increasing diversity.
That's right. And like I said before, one worries about that when actually if you look at the data now, you know, that you see, you know, for example, let me just take affirmative action. The Pew did some work on this, looking at the changes from 1987 to 2003. And while the wording can make a difference, you know, white attitudes about this, you know, who were people who were agreeable back in 87 was about 18%. It rose to about 29%. And today it's about 24% of whites, you know, unequivocally are supportive of that. African Americans are actually much more negative toward affirmative action today than they were, 64% in 87 and 55% today. And I think people wouldn't have believed that to be the case.
I was interested. I was taking a look here at your webpage for the center, and at the broad range of things that you are interested in, things like economic conditions for people, workplace issues, consumer attitudes, drug use by young people, mental and physical health. It's all over the place, a very broad range of issues. This is, in a sense, a kind of a side question, but I'm interested for someone who does that kind of work, who does a lot of opinion research, has it become more difficult to get people who are willing to participate, and how do you deal with that? Or maybe that's not the case at all.
No, that's a good question. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, cooperation rates have fallen a lot over the last three or four decades, and people who do particularly population-based studies where they're trying to get a sample of the population, it has become more and more difficult to get the kind of representativeness in samples that you really need. And we spend, you know, almost every day thinking about how do we do it better, how do we get people to cooperate, and so on. Because if you get a large numbers of people turning you down who don't want to participate, then it doesn't allow you to be able to claim that you indeed have representative samples, because the people who don't participate may be very different than the ones who do. So we stand behind our samples now, but we've had to go to extraordinary lengths in order to keep the cooperation rates up among the American public. For example, cell phones are causing us a lot of problems. The last caller was on a cell phone. With the large numbers of the population migrating away from landlines to cell phones, it creates difficulties in terms of getting good telephone samples of people because of that. In fact, you may remember that in the last election, there was a claim that because many young people, you know, were using only cell phones, that may indeed have an impact upon the polling that was leading up to the election, so that we were underrepresenting its support for certain candidates versus others. As it turns out, that wasn't quite true, but it was thought that that might be true.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, James Jackson. He is a social psychologist. He's director of the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan, and he's talking with us by telephone. He was just on the campus here just last week to talk a little bit about some of what he and other colleagues have found in terms of American values, how they may or may not be changing over time, and as we have discussed, how it is that often this picture that we get of an increasingly polarized, divided nation, divided into opposing camps, battling over competing visions of America, is not really a very accurate picture of the country as it is. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have someone to talk with in Urbana, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if I could ask you to combine two of your interests for a moment. you were discussing the issue of mental, emotional health and checking that in the population, I began wondering about the process by which people do adapt or change their thinking in cases where there is a change in the national attitude. It seems that for some ideas, for some evaluations anyway, people go from seeing a behavior or even a status as being first either downright illegal or evil or somehow wrong, and going from an anger or hatred to a more compassionate state of this behavior is the result of emotional or mental error. This status is somehow a psychological problem, so we shouldn't react with anger. We should react with compassion. And as a third step, just accepting that whatever people do or however people define themselves is part of a spectrum. We may not agree, we may not prefer, but, you know, they're just on one end of a long continuum in our own family or group or whatever you want to call it. So how often do people change their attitudes going through this process of they're wrong, they're sick, they're disturbed, they're just extremes, they're just like everybody else but not like me? Can you comment on that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. One of the things you do know, and I heard it in your voice, that the United States as a whole has become much more understanding about mental disorders, for example, in the population, those people who have them, how we treat them, and so on. Now, part of that is a function of the development of, you know, very effective kind of pharmacologic interventions, drugs, if you will, to assist individuals in that. But the fact is that people have become much more tolerant of mental disorders, and perhaps as we've learned about them and become much more understanding about them, that's one of the reasons for the tolerance. So we understand that those come from genetic bases, from family bases, from, you know, traumas and so on that happen to people. And as people became more aware that but for the grace of God go me, people become much more tolerant and understanding. So I think you're right. I think we've become much more tolerant about that. But some things we haven't. For example, capital punishment could be one of the arguments that we may use, that in some ways we lag behind many of the other advanced industrial nations in terms of our willingness to put people to death for certain kinds of purposes. So, you know, like I said, it's a mixed bag. So we become more tolerant about racial issues. We seem to become more tolerant about mental health and mental disorders and what we do about those things. But on some other issues, as a society, we haven't kept up with that same kind of tolerance.
Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455.
Let me correct one thing,
yes,
you said.
Yes, sir.
We are a very big institute, I should indicate. The Institute for Social Research, which I direct, actually we have around 800 people who work here, about 140 scientists. It's a very big institute, and all those other people are doing a lot of work. I get to be the director, so, you know, I do my own work, but a lot of the things you talked about is the result of other large programs of work and other scientists who are work here all the time.
Yes, I wouldn't want to give the impression that you're the only guy who was doing all this.
Let's make sure we get that straight.
No, I'll be
too busy for words, you know.
Again, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. Just to leap over to another major area, I know a specific area of interest of yours, and you've been involved in this work looking at the health and well-being of African Americans. I'm just curious because a study has just come out here, a story has just come out in the and it's come out in the Washington Post that has to do with African Americans and their willingness to be involved in medical experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, the conventional wisdom is that African Americans, they just didn't trust medical researchers based on the kinds of things that happened in the past, particularly in the one big story that perhaps a lot of people have heard about is the Tuskegee Institute's studies on syphilis, where they had African-American men who had syphilis, and they were using them as research subjects, essentially watching them die. It's a story that's quite well known, I'm sure, among African-Americans. And it has been said that black people just don't trust medical researchers. Now, here, a new study that's just come out says, in fact, that's not what's going on at all, that it's not so much a case that African-Americans don't trust medical research, is that medical researchers aren't asking African-Americans to participate.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've actually done some research on this, and while large numbers of African-Americans, in fact, a clear plurality, a majority of African-Americans actually, know about the syphilis studies that were done at Tuskegee. In reality, it doesn't exert much influence on people's decisions at all as to whether they participate or not. What we find is that there are two things that are important: barriers and also beliefs among health service providers that African-Americans don't want to participate, which then leads them not to ask. So we found similar support for those kinds of findings. Now, we do find, though, that the immediate quality of the relationship that African-Americans have with their health service providers is positive, but that's true in terms of getting people to participate. But that's also true for non-African Americans as well. What happens, and why you still see race differences sometimes, is that African Americans are less likely than whites to have a consistent provider. But again, they're also less likely to have health insurance and other kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not in the mix of places in which people get selected to participate in these kinds of things.
Well, then, just making another big leap, what can you say, generally speaking, about, and perhaps we can talk about this in a little bit detail, about the health of black Americans?
Well, the health of black Americans, I mean, and remember, it's actually relative, so that the health of African Americans in this country is better than the health in many other areas of the world in terms of people's health status. On the other hand, in comparison to non-Hispanic whites, particularly in this society, African American health is not all that great. So there maintains a 7 or 8 year differences in terms of mortality. African Americans are more likely to die earlier. They're more likely to suffer chronic disorders. They're more likely to live in longer periods of time, with certain kinds of disorders than others. Most cancer sites, African Americans tend to have more negative outcomes, and so on. So almost on every health dimension, African American health relative to that of non-Hispanic whites is not very good.
Let's talk with another caller here. Someone
sure.
In Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry I haven't caught this from the very beginning of the program, so I hope this isn't an off-topic question. I'm curious to know if you or your institute have studied media as far as how all these social opinions have been manufactured by individuals over, I don't know, maybe the last decade through the Internet age, through some of the spin doctoring going on. And I'll hang up and listen to your reply. Thanks.
It's one thing that we touched on a little bit earlier, but not in a great depth. One of the things we did in this study is to the current study, which I talked about before, is that we tried to get some sense of issues about the ways in which media consumption might influence the particular set of attitudes that people have. I really do believe, and we talked about this, and that the media, as well as people cynically using things for political purposes, it's probably what's accounting for this kind of general belief that indeed there's this great divide that exists among Americans in terms of their morality or their particular set of social and moral values, when in reality the numbers just aren't there. We were talking about the differences between blacks and whites, for example, where people oftentimes look, but the Pew Political Typology did a study in 2003, and they found that 48% of whites believe that it's necessary to believe in God to be moral. 72% of blacks believe that. 89% of blacks believe that religion is a very important part of my life. 73% of whites believe that. If you ask them, should homosexuality be discouraged by society, 55% of blacks believe that, and only 42% of whites believe that. So in some ways, it kind of reverses the standard notion of a African-American, very liberal, progressive kind of a population, being much less conservative than other groups. Mm. It's a much more complicated story.
Well, that's really interesting, because if you take a look at attitudes on those litmus kind of issues, it begins to look like African Americans probably should be Republicans. Of course, as we know, that they have been the most reliable constituency for the Democratic Party for a long time. Do you think that how does one explain that, and does that say something about in the future we might expect that there would be more African Americans who would be, to the extent that people do identify with one party or another, would be more African Americans who were actually inclined to identify as Republicans?
Yeah, that number has been growing, as you well know, and I think the recent numbers are between 6 and 10%. I've seen different polls on that of African Americans who claim to be Republicans when asked with regard to their orientation, and that's a change. African Americans have historically voted Democratic in terms of what they're doing, and in my talk the other day, I did happen to answer a question which came in off the cuff. And what I argued was that African Americans as a group have been more likely to vote their particular interest than any other group in the United States. And historically, the Democratic Party, which has been concerned with issues of union positions and the more common man sort of thing, that African Americans are more willing to vote for those particular candidates. On the other hand, though, it raises the question about other groups. It's not clear to me why someone who was a union member might have voted Republican in the last election. I think that's a more interesting question, actually. It's not so much that African Americans vote their kind of economic interests with regard to the political parties. One of the questions is why do individuals who are in certain kinds of working class households and others, why do they vote Republican, and how do they see that being in their own economic interests? So I guess that's the question that people could ask.
I have about 15 minutes left,
right,
and I would like to again introduce the guest, James Jackson. He's professor at the University of Michigan. He's a social psychologist. He is director of the Institute for Social Research. He's also director of the Program for Research on Black Americans and senior research scientist at the Institute for Social Research. And he is particularly interested in things like cultural influences on mental health, on aging and human development, was just here on the campus last week and gave a talk talking about America's Americans' evolving values, and we thought that would make an interesting conversation here, and so he's with us by telephone. Questions again, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone over in Bloomington, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I had a question about the racism and religious intolerance that towards people from the Middle East that had its genesis in 9/11. And I was wondering how you thought that those cultural feelings have affected people's opinions about foreign policy, and to what extent those feelings have been made acceptable by the media, by common culture, and especially by the administration.
I won't necessarily speak to the administration, but, you know, 9/11 was a very important event and process in American lives. We actually followed up a national sample of people who were interviewed right after the 9/11 events, and followed them up over several months and almost a year, actually, looking at these particular issues. Again, it's very difficult to characterize Americans with one broad brush. We did find, for example, that American attitudes toward Muslims did harden over that particular period of time. But that when asked about American Muslims, that is with a hyphen, if you will, versus Muslims in the other part of the world, there were huge differences between those. And Americans were much more negative about Muslims, for example, from the Middle East, than they were about Muslims who were American Muslims or those who lived here. So, again, Americans have a more nuanced view in terms of their particular attitudes. You know, again, some people have claimed, you know, that we're involved with this large, you know, cultural clash that revolves around, you know, broad issues of civilization, Christian versus Muslim, and so on. But you have a hard time finding that kind of simplistic black-white difference, if you will, existing in the American public. It's a much, you know, Americans are much. You know, a much more tolerant and understanding and reasonable group of people than I think some people give them credit for. And again, while you could see that attitudes would have hardened toward Muslims from the Middle East, you know, they did not harden in the same way toward individuals who are Muslim Americans. And I think that one reason why that's true, and I talked about this quite a bit, is that America is a nation of immigrants. We are an immigrant country. You know, people come here, you know, to escape religious intolerance and to find economic freedom and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's our kind of ideology. And, you know, we have tended historically to be pretty tolerant about these particular differences.
And has there been a correlation between supporters for the Iraq War and those opinions, or would there not be a correlation? I'll hang up. Thank you.
You know, that's a very good question. I don't know personally what the answer to that is. And of course, because you've not piqued my curiosity, I will go and take a look. You know, at the beginning, people really wanted to kind of lash out at whatever they could lash out at, and out of anger and concern to what happened in this country. And nothing like that ever happened in this country. And you could see why people would support, you know, policies and procedures that that would try to achieve some justice, if not revenge. And again, you know, and only time will tell as to whether, again, these feelings were used to the political ends of other issues. Some people are claiming that now. I don't know about that. All the data are not in. But certainly you can see why initially there was such support, you know, for example, for the war in Iraq, when Iraq was presented as a place which not only sheltered individuals who were involved with regard to planning for 9/11, but actually harbored them and promoted that.
We have about 5 minutes left. We have a couple of callers, so we'll try to get in at least one, if not more. We'll go to Chicago for the next. Line one. Hello.
Hi. With the research that I saw, blacks historically have been Republican because that was the party of Lincoln, and the move over to the Democratic Party was during Franklin Delano Roosevelt's time, and I think a lot to do with Eleanor Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And my question is, I think that people who move into the Republican Party in the present time is usually because they're single-issue turnover, and I don't think that African-Americans ever vote single-issue. I mean, I think that the tendency is more that there'll be multiple reasons, but never a single issue, and I just see perhaps a lot of converts to the Republican Party are single issue, just like your opinion of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think I commented a little bit on it. I mean, I think it's a very, very unstable coalition, you know, to put together people who are single issues. And you're right. Historically, the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, was what blacks favored. But, you know, post-slavery, post-Reconstruction, and then into you know, Roosevelt and so on, African Americans did favor that party, which seemed to be support their kind of economic aspirations more so than the other party. But I think in the long run, you know, these kind of single issue coalitions have got to fall apart. They are unstable. You know, how do you keep together people whose issues are really single minded?
Thank you.
All right, let's go to the next caller. This would be Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. A very interesting topic. And being a black American, I totally agree with this gentleman's finding. I think that blacks, and I am of age, I'm in my 50s, mid-50s, and quite frankly, I'm probably more conservative than some of my suggested conservative friends, and I find his findings very much in light of where I am on certain positions. But I tend to vote Democratic, and it's not single issue that prones me to vote that way. Mm. But a very interesting topic, and I'd like to hear more of this in the future. And thanks for a good program.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, let me just make one last comment on that. I think this issue, I mean, to paint, you know, African Americans, you know, in this kind of notion that they give their votes away, or you know, they're not sharp enough to be able to understand, you know, what their votes mean, is really kind of it really misses the mark. Historically, and particularly since the 30s, the young woman's point is well taken. You know, the Democratic Party seemed to have the most hope for African American concerns, and even when the Democratic Party was split with Dixiecrats and others, it still seemed to offer the best hope with regard to gaining citizenship. Now, African Americans gained clear signs of citizenship in the end of the 60s, and today the issues are more around economic justice and opportunities for various different kind of groups in society, and for many African Americans, still, the Democratic Party seems to offer the most hope. On the other hand, there are growing numbers of African Americans who are Republican, who maybe envision their economic fortunes resting more with those particular sets of philosophies and so on. And for those African Americans, they tend to vote what they see as their social and economic interest, and will vote Republican. But that's one of the things that we're studying right now, as a matter of fact.
We're just about at the point where we're going to have to stop. And,
yeah.
And there was one question that someone raised. I think it's an interesting one that they raised off the air, and I can't give you very much time to talk about this. But the question was, what should we be expecting in terms of American attitudes, or potentially change in American attitudes, or the impact on politics of the increasing percentage of the population that's Latino?
I think what will happen here is that the Latino infusion into the American culture will continue the United States as being a very much an advanced industrial nation, but still having and maintaining very solid traditional kinds of values, because this is these immigrants are coming from places of strong traditional values, and it's really what makes the United States very peculiar among all advanced industrial nations, that indeed it's a place where we have very advanced thinking, kind of rational particular thought, more movement toward modernity, but at the same time, a place of strong kind of traditional values. So I think that's what's going to be the impact.
Well, we're going to have to stop.
All right.
With our thanks to our guest, James Jackson. He's director of the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. Professor Jackson, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. I enjoyed it myself. I enjoyed the callers, as a matter of fact.
Glad to have you with us. And by the way, I guess I mentioned, too, if there are folks who are listening who are interested in the activities of the Institute for for Social Research, they do indeed have a website, which you just type that into your browser or go to the main page of the University of Michigan. I'm sure that you can find them, and you can see the results of a lot of the survey work that has been done there. Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Tomorrow morning on the show, it's the first Wednesday, Doyle Moore will be stopping by, and we'll talk about food and cooking as we do. And have been doing now for a long time. We always have a good time on the first Wednesday with him. Then in the second part of the hour, the guest will be Sean Wilentz. I should say in the second hour, Sean Wilentz. He's professor of history, director of the program in American Studies at Princeton, and we'll be talking about a new book that he has authored, which is entitled The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, in which he makes the argument that indeed things could have gone substantially differently if you take a look at the direction of American history, not in the most democratic way, indeed. And we'll talk a little bit about how things did go and why they went that way tomorrow morning in hour number two. Right now, though, we'll finish up here and turn things over to Celeste Quinn. She's the host of the Afternoon Magazine. She will now be with you for the rest of the afternoon.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our topic is aging gracefully, and our guest will be Dr. Andrew Weil. He is the author of many books on traditional and non-traditional approaches to health and healthy living. His latest book is Healthy Aging. He joins us at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look now at what's happening on in the markets. And December wheat, Kansas. December wheat trading at 363, that down 4. Chicago Board of Trade, December wheat, 299 and a half, down 5.